Welcome to the Experiencing Financial Contentment podcast. In this monthly digest, I cover the main ideas and talking points, the Cliff Notes version, if you will, from the previous month's releases on my YouTube channel. Please visit www.youtube.com/theyoutubecfp to find these and any other videos on the topics of financial literacy, economic empowerment, and personal development. Thanks for listening and enjoy this episode. What is up, everybody? This is Dominique Henderson, your YouTube CFP owner and founder of DJH Capital Management. And the goal here is to help you to do more with your life and money. And I want to welcome you to this July 2019 summary episode for all of the video episodes on the YouTube channel. And this has been going great. We've gotten some really good feedback, and we're going to keep it rolling. And really the purpose, just for anyone that's listening right now for the first time, is to give you a Cliff Notes version of everything we talked about on the YouTube channel in the past month. And I guess this could be titled Rants, Raves, Reactions, and the like, because we did a little bit of everything last month. And the other thing is I really want to give you some, you know, behind the scenes of what maybe I was thinking about when I did the video, or maybe some comments that struck me after it was recorded, and, you know, just different resources. So this is definitely in addition to the YouTube episodes, and I definitely want you to keep watching those. You know, this is kind of like a Cliff Notes version, like I said, and you can get, you know, more bang for your buck as the supplement. I'm also very, very excited to announce, a change in format somewhat over the next few months. You will see this. And if you've been following me for a while, I've done these changes because I don't like to be static. I like to be dynamic. I like to change as, you know, different points in my life allow for that, or even call for that. Based on what's going on. And so I've really honed down on my three-pronged approach in the way that the YouTube channel and the social media will play into that is I have a strong, deep passion for seeing individuals that want to serve as financial advisors come into this space, learn the craft, become really, really good at financial advice, as well as helping people. And I want to be more of an advocate for that. So you'll be hearing much more about that in the coming months. But just to let you know that we'll be way more content than what I've been producing in the past on that particular subject. How to get in, who you need to connect with in the industry, things you just need to know as a financial practitioner if you're going to want to work with people. So it'll be more targeting people that are, let's call it, at the beginning stage versus people that have been in the industry for a while. But I would say that both groups should be able to get something out of the new format. So I don't want to keep you waiting. Let's jump right into week one and start to talk about what we covered there. This was how to recover from investment losses. So this came to me while I was in a conference, and I was just kind of thinking through how people may not really understand the concept of getting back to even. Now, what do I mean by getting back to even? So if you got an investment portfolio, let's say you started with $100,000, you lose 10%, you go down to $90,000. Well, how much does it take from a math standpoint to get you back to even and then start, you know, compounding and allow the power of compounding working for you? Well, most people would say 10%, but that's not, the math is not correct. Or that answer is not correct. The math of it actually means that if you lost 10%, you would have to make back 11% to get back to even. And so when you start to lose more, you have to make up a bigger number. And I don't have my calculator in front of me right now to do all this math, but check out the episode because I give you the exact formula to figure that out. But this is what I want you to be thinking about and what I was kind of thinking about when I was in this conference. I was saying, you know, suffering a huge loss in your strategy really negates the power of compounding, right? So just to go over this real quick, you know, when you have $100,000 that makes $10,000, that $10,000 obviously is added to your principal of 100. So you have 110. And now the 110 starts to make money, right? And then you just keep on layering that on, at least that phenomenon on, and that is the power of compounding. But again, if you lose or have a big negative month, and I'm going to give you an example. Let's say you have two people that both start with $1 million in the nest, right? And it doesn't matter the time period because the math still works out. However, but if they both average 10%, but in two different ways, right? And the first person that averages 10% over the length of their investment horizon, their first year, they lost 30%. And then after it, they had whatever numbers they needed in order to average 10%. And then the second person just averaged a straight 10% all the way. The two ending amounts will be drastically different. They get even worse depending on, you know, obviously the market cycles. But if you have a shorter time span, there obviously will be a pretty drastic difference if you start off with that big negative. And my point is, you really need to know your appetite for risk to kind of avoid those swings in the market, because you can craft a portfolio that is more, less volatile and will not have those big, you know, gargantuan swings that you may not be able to afford. You know, I worked in this industry during the Great Recession, and it was really sad to see people that were on the cusp of retiring, but then suffer a 40% loss in, you know, 2008. Then they had to make up, the math of it was 67% in the following year just to get back to even. And you don't want to do that, you know, let's call it 5 years away from retirement or 2 years away from retirement. So you want to be way more attuned to what your appetite for risk is in crafting a portfolio around that. So that's what the main gist around how to recover from investment losses was about. And you don't need a financial advisor. I sure hope that I did not confuse people with this title on the thumbnail. If you watch the video on YouTube, though, you know that I was really just trying to give Phil Town from Real One Investing a hard time. So now Phil is an industry vet. He is probably best known for some of his workshops where he is essentially teaching individuals on how or techniques on how to invest your money. And he has an approach that is more so about picking, you know, really good companies and holding those companies for the long term. Very, very similar to what Warren Buffett did back in the 50s and his mentor, Benjamin Graham. Now, there's a more efficient way, and we can go back and forth on this. But there's a more efficient way to pick companies. Obviously, you can do index funds or you can do mutual funds. You can do all these different types of things because, you know, the normal person, and he'll play this down, but the normal person really doesn't have, I would say, the time, energy, and then sometimes the know-how on what companies to pick, how to choose those, what criteria to use. Obviously, he's teaching you this in his workshop, and you pay for this knowledge that he's leveraging through the workshop. So he has his own angle too, but that's neither here nor there. Here's what I have a problem with on why I reacted to the video that I chose on Phil Town talking about you don't need a financial advisor or questioning the notion of whether or not you needed a financial advisor. I would say, or anybody that's listened to me for a while has heard me say that financial planning is not about the math. And I will further that by saying that you'll find that investing is just one component of financial planning, right? There's other aspects. There's tax strategy. There is asset protection. You know, you make this big pile of money. You don't have a will. It goes to probate. And all these people that you don't know, including the government, divvies out your estate. Now, nobody wants that. The other aspect I would say is cash flow managing and budgeting. And there's behavioral finance in this. There's just a ton of things that go into developing a complete financial plan besides just what stocks you pick to put in your portfolio. Now, given you have the right financial advisor, you can really go far and bring a very secure plan for the future. And so what I took issue with particularly on this video is his definition of financial advisor, because it was not this caring individual that knows your children's names and, you know, when you were married and sends you birthday cards every year. He more so painted the picture of this suited up wealth manager in the 40-story skyscraper that works for a big company that's just trying to charge you fees. And I would refute that. I would say that a lot of the colleagues that I work with for the 20 years that I've been doing this, they're not that impersonal picture that he painted. It's much more of a meaningful relationship. You know, these are people that have come into my office. They've shared family photos. They have, you know, come in some instances giving me, you know, very, very secret details to their lives that I've taken into confidence in order to give them an outlet to feel better about where they're going with their finances. So, I mean, this was totally a different person that I'm painting than what Phil Town was talking about. And I just take issue with using that vernacular or that term to describe people that give financial advice, that work as hard as I do to help their clients achieve the goals, calling, you know, lumping those all in with wealth managers, mutual fund managers, and people that run mutual funds. So that's what that was about. And I didn't want to confuse people, but I did want to grab your attention. I figured that if I put that title up there and you know what I'm about, that it would definitely get some eyeballs on it. So hopefully I was successful in that venture. Let's move on to what we talked about in week three. All right, this was my rant alert about the financial advice industry. And I will say, as a not so shameless plug, there is a blog article on my website right now. And you can read that, and it goes further into this whole notion about the financial advice industry and maybe things that, you know, I think I titled it How Difficult It Is to Find Good Financial Advice. And this was really born out of a couple of different things. I think, you know, as a business owner and practitioner in this particular industry, I find it, I would say, unnecessarily difficult to find new clients and new business, not from the standpoint that I don't have a good widget and that I don't render good financial advice and things of that nature. That is a whole different bag where you're, you know, trying to establish a brand, a marketing scheme, and all that other kind of stuff. What I'm talking about is more from a regulation standpoint. I'm talking about more of the imposters that are in the industry that bring a bad name, that, you know, cause more awareness and or education to be needed around the subject so people can differentiate. I'm talking about that part. So the marketing part and all that, you know, that's just what you got to do. You got to pay your dues so people can know, like, and trust you. But how I looked at this is, how would I change the industry? And I kind of alluded to this at the top of this podcast recording about what I'm going to be doing in the second half of this year and beyond in regards to helping people get into this industry. But let's start with the number one thing on the list, and that is just to get better advisors out there, right? So better advisors out there means that, you know, you've got to raise the bar. It shouldn't be so easy to get into this industry. And I've said this before, so I'm not revealing any new information, but you can basically study for a test, which may take you anywhere from 30 to 90 days, and you can get your 7 and 66, and you can open up a registered investment advisory firm. To me, that's too low of a bar. I just don't know that, you know, 90 days or a quarter worth of study is going to prepare you for helping people plan to the degree that they need. Again, beyond just investments, you know, there's different elements of this, and I'm not going to go through all those again. You can, you know, kind of consume some of the content on my YouTube channel to kind of see what I think are the at least four core elements of financial planning. But here's my point. The industry needs better advisors. It needs less regulation, and it also needs better methods of financial education that starts really early, like as early as elementary school, teaching kids about financial literacy and allowing them to see the things that money can help them accomplish and having the right view of money. All these things are very important to allowing this field that I'm in of financial advice, financial, you know, planning, if you will, to be more viewed as a regarded profession. And the only way you do that is to raise the bar, raise the standard. Now, does this certified financial planner CFP designation need to be the standard? Maybe, maybe not. I'm pretty agnostic about that. Obviously, I do hold that, but I have held other licenses, and I do have an advanced degree in finance. But here's the point. I think you just need to get qualified people in there. Like, I would say that, you know, 5 years of experience, you need to have dealt with different client cases. You need to have had hopefully a background in finance or some business discipline, economics, accounting, something like that, so that you can have what I would just for the individual get into the industry, you know, a shorter learning curve. If you come from a totally different discipline like engineering or, you know, social sciences or something like that, there are obviously crossovers and overlaps in that. But it still does not, you know, beat knowing macroeconomics or microeconomics or the principles of finance or, you know, principles of accounting and things of that nature that are all going to be useful in this discipline. So definitely check out the blog article. I would be curious as to what you think could change in the industry, and maybe as a consumer of financial services, how you view the industry and what are some things that, you know, you would like to see. I would love to hear all those comments, and I would more than likely respond to all of them. I recently met with a colleague, and if you're listening to this now and you want to get into the industry, you're going to want to keep listening. Because I'm really excited about what I think can happen here. My alma mater, Purdue A&M University, now has a financial planning minor, which is approved by the CFP board to help individuals prepare and or sit for the exam, basically becoming a certified financial planner. And I think that's really cool. I'll be doing some partnering with this program even as early as this fall to help start to educate the students on the opportunities and, you know, just the broad array of things that you can do in this industry. You don't have to necessarily be like I am, facing clients one-on-one. You know, there's different aspects of this because, you know, some people are good, you know, face-to-face. Some people are good behind the scenes. So there's a lot of different levels of interaction and engagement and job opportunities that you can take advantage of. And I want to be one of those advocates and proponents for helping you find those. So I'll be sharing a lot about what I do, what I've learned, the people I've worked with, and things of that nature going forward. So if you're interested, make sure you stay tuned because I have a lot more in store for you. Let's move on to week four. I really hope you're enjoying this executive summary. And if so, I want to hear from you. You can send me your comments from the same location that you downloaded this episode. Or if you want bonus points, you can email me at info@djh-capital.com. That is info@djh-capital.com. And let me know what kind of topics you'd like for me to cover in future episodes. Look, my goal is to see you do more with your life and money, okay? Now let's get back to the podcast. In week four, it was double your pleasure as I released two episodes, one pre-recorded and one live stream. All right, so that Monday, I provided you with some ways to not be scammed by anyone posing to be a financial advisor, because that does happen. And really, the gist behind this episode was just to give you some cues, some red flags, some things to be aware of, you know, because one of the things that I always am, you know, particularly I would say that I'm always surprised by the question, although I know it's coming at some point with just the different people that I interact with as far as people that are looking to be clients or prospective clients. But the question is always somewhat of a surprise. But the question is, how do I know I can trust you? And I'll get into just, you know, the answers that I give in just a second. But I think the gist behind this episode was to give you things to be aware of, because there is the likelihood that if you, you know, go seeking a financial advisor or a financial planner, that there's a couple of steps that you're going to need to go through and to make sure this person is legitimate and things of that nature. Even if they were a referral from a friend that you know, things change. You just need to be aware as a consumer, just because of the raised standard that I said that this industry needs. A lot of, just to be really honest, a lot of trash and garbage gets into the filter, and you definitely don't want to be working with any one of those people. All right, so when somebody asks me, how do I know I can trust you? I think it's a very, very valid question. I'm not offended by that question. I think when that question is asked, what I'm noticing, though, is there's two things that could be at play here. The first is that they could have had a bad experience prior to that, right? And I can't invalidate that. That is what happened to them. We definitely need to work through that, because there could have been some established logic, a mindset that needs to be challenged, because they just have the wrong information based on their experience. Their experience is what their experience is, but they could have formed some faulty logic based off of it. And then I would say the second thing is they really are just dealing with a lack of education around, you know, kind of what to ask besides that question. Now, how do I know I can trust you is a valid question, but it's not the right question, right? So let me give you just a little bit more than what I gave in the YouTube. So one of the first things you want to be thinking about when you're working with a financial advisor is when you come to them, you're coming to them for a need. I very rarely get a person that I'm talking to that has not had some type of event happen, whether that be divorce, death, disability, an inheritance, a new job. You know, like, you have an event that happens. Very rarely do people just come up to me and say, hey, yeah, everything's going fine, I just want a financial advisor. That doesn't work like that. So from that standpoint, you need to take the context of the event that just happened, and you need to use that to search for who you want. So for instance, let's say you are moving to another part of the country to accept another job, and you're trying to compare whether or not you should stay in that job you have right now or go into the next job, and you want to compare the benefit structure and the comp plan and yada, 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 and you want somebody to evaluate that. Well, financial advisors can do that. So you want to go with somebody that has some expertise around employee benefits and how to evaluate those. And especially if you have other things in there like RSUs, you know, and stock options and restricted stock and things of that nature. So you want somebody that has that particular expertise. Or if you're about to get a divorce, you want somebody that has expertise there. So there's actually financial advisors that are credentialed in just that specialty of divorce. So the point is, instead of how do I not trust you? Because those are table stakes, right? You got to be able to trust the person, and hopefully you've been able to pick up on them in some type of qualitative measure by the questions you've been asking in the conversation prior to hiring them, whether or not they're trustworthy. But you do want to go with one of the more quantitative things, I would call, is what is their area of expertise? What is their area of specialty? The other thing you want to make sure is that, and this word is so overused, I almost hate to use it right now, but just so you know, we're talking about fiduciary, which basically means that they're putting your interests before their own. Someone that is giving financial advice that is incentivized by more than what you're going to pay them, but in maybe some under the hand, no, I'm sorry, not under the hand, but some type of other under the table compensation, or even, you know, just extra compensation. If they are getting compensation outside of what you're paying them by a product that they sell or a service that they sell, make sure they disclose that up front. There's nothing inherently wrong with getting a commission on anything, but if you don't disclose the fact that you're getting a commission, I have to question whether or not you're giving me the advice that I need based on how you are incentivized. That's just a natural course of things. So these are some of the questions that I think are more substantive and reveal more of the motive and the nature of the person you're working with, besides saying, how do I know I can trust you? Because they're going to tell you some of everything. Unfortunately, in this industry, they can't necessarily refer you to clients for testimonials, because that is against the, I think it's called Rule 203, but it's against the Investment Advisors Act that has all the rules governing this profession. So you may rarely find client testimonials to use as social proof. But even then, you need to have your own set of questions that you ask. And I think even more than all that is, what is the level of comfort? Like, do they pass the sniff test at the end of the day? Do they seem weird? Are they making eye contact when they talk to you? You know, all these type of things, I think, are some of the qualitative things that you can use. All right, so I got a little long-winded on there because you can tell I'm very passionate about it. The other cool treat was sitting down with Miss Shayna Green of The Wealth Vibe. She is a very highly educated public health professional in Atlanta. And we chopped it up for about 60 minutes, basically in a live stream session, talking about or chronicling her debt-free journey. And so she started with about $108,000 18 months ago, and she's more than halfway there. I think she says she's got about 54 or 53 left. So if you just do the math, it's very close to $3,000 a month paying off debt in addition to what she's living off of. So she's got some really practical stuff on her YouTube channel. Definitely check that out. Check that episode out. I got links to her channel and all that kind of stuff in the show description. But very, very informative, very, very inspirational, very, very motivational. Make sure you check her out and check out that episode. All right, rounding it up, let's bring it in for a landing and talk about week five real quick. All right, last but not least, week five was five habits of the wealthy or the rich. You know, I was basically trying to talk about some money habits, money mindset, things that you can do to improve your situation and really emulate some of the things that I've seen the wealthy and the more well-off do or implement into their strategy. And it was on the back of actually a subscriber comment about a video that I did. And I don't know, this comment probably came in more than a month ago, but I was finally getting around to, you know, just some thoughts around this after kind of like mulling through one of the questions that they asked in it, which was, you know, hey, Dominique, based on your practice, do you think people get locked into mindsets that, you know, don't serve them as they age? And they were interested in hearing those stories, hearing about those stories. And I thought the best way to address that is just to talk about what I felt were the healthy money mindset. So I gave you five, and I've gotten way more than this, but you know, if I'm just thinking about a top five things, you know, you gotta be a saver, right? Saving at least some portion of every dollar you make. I think the book I referenced in the episode was George Clason's Richest Man in Babylon, where, you know, there's the parable about saving at least 10 cents of every dollar, something like that. So I think it basically intimates you need a budget, right? You need some way to know what's going in and coming out and have a good beat on that. Not just be thinking that, oh, I'll get a budget when I start making money. You know, you need to have a design or a strategy for the money before it comes in. That's really key. I think most of the people that I see have more, what I would call more month than money, don't have a budget. And it doesn't have to be something complex. It can be really, really simple. I've used several different frameworks and given a lot of examples. So make sure you just kind of, if you want help, you can search the term budget on my YouTube channel. And there should be at least three or four videos that pop up that give you some tips on what you can use. Even a very simple spreadsheet format or template that I've given out before. The other thing I would say is a good money habit, healthy money habit, would be to outsource what you don't know or understand. You know, one of the people always ask me, what's the biggest financial mistake you've ever seen a person make? And I would say it falls into this category. buying something you don't need, as you know, as much as a house. I've seen six-figure mistakes like that really, really set you back because you're playing catch-up for a lot of your financial life, which causes stress, anxiety, frustration, a lot of different things. You know, can throw you off with your spouse. So then you have marital issues that may lead even to divorce. And this is all just from, you know, going after something that you really didn't need. And that's not even to say that you have to hire somebody to give you input on every financial decision you're going to make, but you just got to be a little bit more prudent. Stupid tax is the term that Dave Ramsey used. And I would definitely agree with that. Stupid tax is typically pretty expensive. I would say pay cash for mostly everything. I know this is really hard, but it helps you build the muscle of delayed gratification. You know, you can't have everything you want right now. Although we live in the culture that says that you can, but realistically you can't. You have limited time, you have limited money, and you have to allocate that over what seems to be unlimited choices. It's the definition of prudent financial planning, is figuring out the trade-offs on how to do that. So, One way to do that is just to discipline yourself to pay cash for everything. If you have credit cards and you use them, pay them off monthly and avoid carrying those balances over. I would say the other thing that you need to do, I've seen the wealthy have the appropriate amounts of insurance, which is twofold, right? It's having the right types of insurance and not paying too much for each of those types. And in the episode, I went over what I would call the three majors when it comes to the types of protection you need. So definitely peruse that. But the last would be investing your money in the right type of assets. And I use the term, I thought more about this after I recorded it, because the term risk assets probably connotates something that you're scared of. But I did differentiate between risk and risky in that episode. But the point is you need to be in the right type of assets. And the right type of assets are the assets that will grow beyond inflation. You definitely don't want to pay, you know, let's say a dollar for a loaf of bread now. In 20 years, that same loaf of bread costs $2, but your money hasn't grown to $2. It's grown to less than $2 because you didn't have it in the right assets because you were scared and you just kept the money under your mattress or something like that. That's the type of things you want to avoid, because that's not going to help you become wealthy. So you need a good mix of assets, and we don't need to get into that right now, but you know, they need to be composed of things that will grow over time. So that's really the gist of the episode on the five healthy habits for building wealth or gaining riches. So that wraps up July's executive summary of our video podcast. And look, if you're listening and you want to become a part of the tribe, we would love to have you. I'd love to connect with you, and here's how to do that. You could obviously go to the YouTube channel, which I've been referencing throughout this summary podcast. At youtube.com/theYouTubeCFP. Make sure you put that definite article THE in front of YouTube CFP. You can also subscribe to the blog. This is when I'm releasing different types of content, you know, maybe a couple articles a month, depending on the flavor of the podcast. I generally let the podcast dictate whether or not I'm going to write a supplemental article about whatever subject that is. But you can always find that at djh-capital.com/blog. Would love to get your input. I'm always there for some intellectual calisthenics there if you want to challenge me. I'm down for it, so I would love to hear from you. Or you can just be old-fashioned and send me an email. That email address is info@djh-capital.com. And obviously, if you enjoyed this episode, please leave me a comment and tell me what impacted you the most. I love to hear from you. I always read all these comments, and I would love to know what interests you going forward. You know, if you want me to do an episode about something differently than what I've been talking about, definitely submit that idea, and I will do my best to try to accommodate. Maybe there are others out there that want to hear the same thing, so you never know. Remember, I am here to help you make the bigger, better decision with your life and money, and I will talk to you later. Bye for now.